Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Winter is Coming, a housing justice podcast. And this is a series where we are having conversations exploring how we go from housing crisis to housing justice in our communities. And we take the particular lens of where many of us in these conversations are the land that we're living on, which you might know now and on your Google Maps as Kitchener-Waterloo. But this is the traditional territory for thousands of years of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and the Neutral peoples who stewarded this land long before with much more intention and care than us as settlers have. And that is the land that we're talking about. And we're excited to dive in this week with my friend and a fellow camp alumni and Hub Community Network sub-hubber, Gemma Ricker, who is also a former staff at the Working Center. And for those who don't know, the Working Center is an incredible organization in KW that's been around for decades, serving the street-involved community, working alongside those who experience housing insecurity, and they've been doing amazing work for quite a long time. And Gemma has been gracious enough to come on and chat about her her time at the Working Center and her experiences. So Gemma, thank you for being here this week. Thanks for making time to be here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on the podcast.
Awesome. We're glad to have you. And we are talking in this series about housing justice. And we talk about housing justice. We use that phrase to kind of express how this is a kind of large and sprawling a problem that we face that isn't contained simply to soaring house prices in market real estate or mortgage rates. It's not specifically contained to one region, and it's also not specifically contained to just those folks who are street involved. Because as we talked about in our episode with Kirsten Wright, this crisis is a threat to growing poverty at many income levels. And so we talk about housing justice to look at how do we not just get roofs over people's heads, but how do we move towards society, communities, cities, neighborhoods, provinces, and whole countries that really have housing enshrined as a human right. And so you have been working in the past at the Working Center. Tell us a little bit, how did you get involved with the Working Center originally?
Yeah, so I graduated from my undergrad in 2021. And I studied peace and conflict studies. That's what my undergrad is in. And I really enjoyed my program. Took a lot of courses in social development studies as well, because that interested me. So I took courses, I took a course called Homelessness and Public Policy, and I took courses on environmental justice, trauma and healing, using a trauma-informed approach. So I had a little bit of educational background sort of in the field. And when I graduated, I immediately started looking for a job because it was the middle of the pandemic. And I know that lots of people, once they finish their undergrad, maybe take some time off to do something else or travel or something. And it was in the middle of a lockdown. So I didn't have the opportunity.
Not a lot of great travel opportunities. Not a lot of backpacking through Europe opportunities in the last couple of years.
Exactly. And on top of that, I didn't really need a break because I'd been sitting in my room for the last 8 months doing school online. So I'd already been at home so much. So I actually ended up getting this job like a week after I graduated. I didn't have any time because I felt like I was also ready, you know, to get out of my apartment. So anyways, I graduated and I was, you know, I immediately started looking for jobs. And I was interested in working, you know, in the area. I was interested in staying in the KW area. And I found this job posting on Indeed that the Working Center was hiring for supportive housing workers. And I was a little bit familiar with the Working Center. I knew that they ran the soup kitchen, St. John's Kitchen in mm-hmm. Kitchener, but yep. I'd never been there. I'd never volunteered there. I'd never actually interacted with the Working Center otherwise in any other way. I had just heard the name before, but I didn't know all that much about them. Anyways, I got this job, again, just found it on Indeed, and I didn't know very much what I was stepping into. And I worked in their supportive housing, which we'll get into kind of what that looks like. I worked in the supportive housing for a few months and I was working on the night shift there. So I would get on my bike at 11 at night and bike down University off the campus, down University Avenue and to work. And then I would bike home at 7 in the morning. And yeah, it was like a really interesting experience. And then after a few months, I had the opportunity to move within the working center to working at St. John's Kitchen. And that's where I spent the last year working. And then, so yeah, so I worked at St. John's Kitchen for a year after that. So that's how I got involved in the working center.
Nice. So like you said, directly out of your undergrad, like a week later, you were diving in. What was, talk about going from the kind of world of academia in, you know, post-secondary and then diving, you know, right into, what some of us in like, liberative Jesus traditions might call the incarnational, when you, or other people might say right in the thick of it, in the trenches, on the front line, in a very lived experience, practical way. You went from not only, I guess, not only academia and studying, but like end of, like the end of your career there was the start of the pandemic. And so, like you said, in your apartment, finishing school at a laptop, and then going right into kind of the front lines of working there with the working center, working alongside folks who are street involved or are housing insecure. And what was that? What was that shift like, going from the laptop into the working center?
Yeah, so it was interesting because it was like going right from theory to practice. So I had just been, you know, learning about this stuff, but just in theory. I was sitting in university, I was sitting amongst people who were not dealing directly with the housing crisis, with homelessness, with the opioid crisis. I was sitting amongst university students who had housing, and I was learning about, you know, for example, how to use a trauma-informed approach in any type of work. And then when I started at the working center, they started to train us at how to use a trauma-informed approach. So I was using that stuff that I learned in school directly where I was working. So I didn't take it right from theory to practice. I don't remember it being too big of a transition, even though we were like had all been at home for a long time just before I started working there. It was pretty natural just to jump back in and, you know, start being around people and working in housing and being around people all the time, like every night, every shift. It was pretty exciting.
Nice. Yeah. You talked about specifically what we're looking at here and what a lot of your experiences were around supportive housing. And I think that's one thing that is we've talked a little bit so far on the podcast about this idea of the housing continuum and that the continuum stretches all the way from what we might traditionally look at as those who are living on or close to the streets, street involved folks, what we might have in the past called homelessness, all the way to where the other end of the continuum, where there's market real estate. And so the idea of somebody getting a down payment and being able to get a mortgage and buy a house. But in between those phases of the continuum are these other phases. And housing justice wants to work to get people along that continuum. And at least, although what we would probably also say housing justice would have, we would have a lot to say about how market real estate and that end of the continuum needs to change. But in between those who are living close to the streets and those who are able to own houses, we have these other phases of the continuum, including emergency response, emergency shelters, supportive housing, accessible housing, affordable housing, transitional housing. So you have had experience then working in supportive housing. Can you help us as listeners and as me, as I said lots of times, I'm not an expert in this. What is supportive housing? What does that look like? How might that differ from something like an emergency shelter? And how might it differ from something like just, you know, market real estate housing? What is supportive housing?
Great. Yeah, let's get into it. So supportive housing can, I think, look like different things. It's a broad umbrella term. So it can look like different things in different contexts. You've talked about on this podcast before, on your previous episodes, about how we need to have multiple different solutions. There's not one solution to the housing crisis. There needs to be multiple different solutions. And so This is one solution, and it's not the solution for everyone who's dealing with housing insecurity, but it is for some. So that's why it's really important, for us to consider all sorts of different solutions. So in this case, what supportive housing looks like, maybe I'll talk first about why it looks different from a shelter or how it looks different from an emergency shelter.
Yeah.
So an emergency shelter is somewhere that people will go at night. And if it is a true emergency shelter, say one that's like opened up in the winter, you have to be there by whatever time it is, 8 p.m., 9 p.m. at night. You get your bed if you get there in time. If you don't, you don't get a bed. You stay there for the night. And then in the morning, you pack up all your belongings at 8 in the morning, whatever time you have to leave. And then you leave for the day. And then you get back in line at night. And you hope that you can get a bed that night too. And that is an emergency shelter. You don't leave any of your possessions there. There are often lots of rules around what you can and can't do in the shelter. Substance use, pets, couples, mm-hmm. you've talked a little bit about before. So there are lots of barriers to people accessing emergency shelters. Mm-hmm. In this case, the idea with, so I'm going to call it UA, and that stands for University Ave, or University Avenue. So the building that the working center is using is on University Avenue. So that's why we're saying UA.
Gotcha, right.
Yeah. So UA was opened in October 2020. And the idea was to have a space for people to live for an especially vulnerable population of people who couldn't or wouldn't otherwise access shelter. And it can be hard for some people to imagine why people would choose to live on the streets instead of sleeping inside in a shelter, but there are lots of barriers to shelter. So I kind of made a little list of like some of the ones that came to mind. So some of the barriers to accessing shelter is that people can't have pets. So that's often, you know, their life companion. You can't bring your pets into shelter.
Yeah, Steph talked about that in her experiences as well. And I mean, for people listening, the idea of what would you do if your pet was not able to come with you, like that's a choice. I mean, people have to think about these things, and it's easy for us who, those of us who have shelter to just think about maybe when I go away for a weekend, who's going to watch this? And so that's a really good point that people don't think about is, what do you do when you have these members of your family, but they are not able to get shelter where you are getting shelter?
Yeah. Like where are you going to leave your dog or your cat? Like, are you going to leave them on the street? Are you going to tie them, you know, to a tree overnight? Like, this is legitimately, like, people will choose to stay on the street because they actually have nowhere to leave their dog or stay in a safe place. Yeah. So, okay, people aren't allowed to stay in couples in shelters. Everyone has their own bed. I think Steph Stretch mentioned that as well. But also, it might just be a men's shelter or just be a women's shelter. And if you're there with your family or with your partner, you can't stay together. And that's not always people's preference for sure. Lots of people just think that they're not safe. People's things get stolen there. And they just don't feel safe staying at shelters. There are also really rigid hours. So people have a lot less freedom to come and go as they please. And if you're someone who's living in housing, you have the freedom, and you may not think about it, but you have the freedom to come back to your house as late as you want and leave as late as you want in the day. And that autonomy is something that I've always taken for granted. I'm sure everyone does. The fact that you can just leave your house anytime and come back anytime, and you don't have to worry that someone else is going to be in your bed and take your spot, is this amount of like personal autonomy that you have that you don't get if you stay in shelters. I just can't remember. I feel like it was a local politician or someone was saying, and they were like, well, people should just stay in shelters. That's the easy solution. But it's not an easy solution. Like, for that person saying that, like, you can't come and go as you please. You have to be there at a certain time. So it's really, really prohibitive. That's why another reason why people may not choose to stay in shelters. And then on top of that, most shelters have a like no drug policy. And that's a really, really big barrier for people. If they can't use or bring their substances inside, they won't choose to stay inside. And then on top of that, people will get service restrictions from shelters. So if you use, potentially, if they find you using inside, they'll say, you know, you're restricted for a day, or you're restricted for a week, or if you get in a fight, you know, you're restricted for a week, and then you can't come back. If you're restricted from the emergency shelter because you were using, then you can't, then you have nowhere to stay that night potentially. So these are all reasons why people would choose not to access shelters. So the vision, I think, behind UA was that there would be a place for people who couldn't access shelters or wouldn't access shelters to have a place to live. So this type of supportive housing, like I said, it's kind of an umbrella term, and there's lots of different types of supportive housing, but this type of supportive housing was specifically for this very vulnerable population. Most people who live in UA are using opioids, and almost everyone, not everyone. So it's a very specific population that they're serving. And supportive housing means that it's staffed 24/7. So I said before, I was working on the night shift. We had three different shifts. There's always staff on site. That's what supportive housing means in this case. And it means that also in this case, there are also other resources on site. So this building opened up, and people can access their beds there. And one of the differences from an emergency shelter is that people actually have a room there, like housing. Like, it's not like a shelter. You have your room and you can come and go whenever you want. And you always have that room, and you don't have to wait in line and wonder if you're going to get a bed that night. Once you have your space, you have it. And you're allowed to have pets in the building as well. And there's couples that are living in the building that would get rooms just beside each other so that they can use those two rooms however they want. And so that really brings down some of the barriers. So it's staffed all the time. You have your own room that you always have. You can come and go as you want. And then there are also, like, everyone has a key to their own room. So you can leave all your possessions in there as well. You don't have to be moving them out every single day. You can, leave your stuff there. And then there are also services that people can access on site. So some of the services are, they have a nurse there during the day, so people can access some, at least, sort of preliminary healthcare or get referred on to, like, the type of healthcare that they need. So they have a nurse on site. They have Sanguine, which is a harm reduction organization on site, for a few hours each day. At least the last that I knew, they were there. So Sanguine gets people safe supplies. So that means needles, pipes, tinfoil, anything that people need to be able to use their drugs safely. Lutherwood, again, when I was working there, this was true. Lutherwood was coming in every week. Lutherwood is a housing organization. So they would come in to help people find more permanent housing. You have outreach workers from the working center on site, also trying to help people find more permanent housing. And there was also the job cafe happening, so people could get jobs just either helping out in the kitchen or helping out, like, helping to, like, clean the bathrooms to make some money. So there was also work for people on site, and there was meals. So people were accessing all of their meals there as well. So in this case, that's what supportive housing meant. There's lots of other services to access on site. So it makes, like, a network of support for these folks, as well as being staffed 24/7.
When you talk about the blessing of, and that this is my word, the blessing of being able to have your possessions, in particular, be able to stay in a place, I think that's really important for us to, again, things that we take for granted, those of us who aren't, who haven't been targeted by housing injustice in the same way, or have had the luck not to be targeted in the same way. To think about what it means to, not have to pack up your things every night, or as many shelters are, have to deny certain things being able to come in. That piece, and when you said that the idea of people being able to have their own keys to their place, when we really talk about it, the dignity piece of something that we would, that I would want for myself, that I would want for my friends and my neighbors, to have that the dignity of saying, this is your place with your stuff, this is your key. And then on top, to know that there are those supportive services is obviously, I think that's really important for us to kind of recognize and to not take for granted, and that to know, and as we talked about in the episode with Steph, with. You know, the people who are running these emergency shelters are, they're doing incredible work in the kind of limited way that an emergency shelter can operate. But we have so often in our political discourse and in our kind of perception of how do we tackle the housing crisis, we've settled for the emergency response being the solution. And of course, that's so it's not to say that these emergency shelters are not that the people working there and volunteering there aren't doing incredible work, but just recognizing that it's a very limited scope of folks who can access that effectively. And even the ones who access it effectively, it's not a long-term solution. So to be able to look past emergency shelters, which is one phase of the continuum, and to look and to create visions and create programs for supportive housing is really, really important for those who have those barriers and those who when we really start to get into, like you said, networks of support for people to actually start to rise through community out of those challenging situations.
Yeah, to that point about having you're not having to pack up your possessions. When I worked at the kitchen for the past year, we have people accessing. So when you work in support, like in the shelter, well, when you work in supportive housing, the nice thing is everyone who you're working with has shelter, like is housed because you're working in supportive housing. So that's great. But when I was working at the kitchen, we were, of course, lots of people who were unhoused were accessing services at the kitchen. So at the end of the day, you know, everyone starts packing up their things. And some people have, you know, spread out during the day and stuff like that, been able to put their stuff down or decided to reorganize their things. I have seen the wildest contraptions of people. They'll have like two backpacks on their back and they'll have this trailer attached to their bike and they load all their things. You know, it's very precarious and they bike away. And you're really carrying all of your life's possessions around with you. And it's really exhausting. Yeah. And then I also remember during the winter, the working center had a winter emergency shelter at St. Andrew's Church in Kitchener.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's not too far from the kitchen, which was really, really great that people could go in between the shelter and the kitchen and always have the opportunity to be somewhere warm. So we had a similar population of people who would stay at the shelter in the night. And then in the morning when the shelter closed, the kitchen would open sort of at the same time. People would come to the kitchen, stay there during the day. When we closed, you know, an hour later, the shelter opened. So it's sort of this continuous care, but people still had to move and they didn't have a permanent place to stay. And I just remember at the end of the day, asking one lady, reminding her that we were closing and asking her if she can start getting her stuff packed up and that we were closing soon. And she had been, I think, napping on the floor because, you know, sometimes it's hard to get a good sleep in the shelter.
Yeah.
And she just sighed and said, it's always get up and get out, get up and get out. It's always like pack your things and get out, because every, you know, 12 hours she's being asked to get up and get out and move to the next place and then move to the next place. Yeah. And it's so mentally and physically exhausting that it just really, really pulled up. Like, yeah, that just really broke my heart when she was saying that, because it was exactly true. And it just speaks to the importance of supportive housing where you're able to stay there 24/7 and come and go when you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Again, I mean, it's hard for us to, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around the toll that takes on emotionally and on people's bodies to be, you know, constantly, to be constantly on the move like that. And, you also talked about in UA and in supportive housing, the ability to have safety and support systems around those who are using substances. Can you talk a little bit about, for those who might be new to this, and again, because there's lots of folks who might be listening and they say, I'm not an expert, I just know that I want to see people be able to be supported and be housed, but they might wonder, why is it important to be able to care for and provide space for people who are using substances? Can you explain a little bit about why it's actually important to provide those things rather than having a policy of saying, if you come here, you're not allowed, to use any substances? Why is it important that we actually support people who are in the midst of lives where they're substance users?
Yeah, great question. So it's no secret that Canada is in the midst of an opioid crisis right now, to say the
Yes.
least. It's just so very serious. And between January and March this year, so earlier this year in 2022, 21 people were dying a day of an overdose death. So we can see that the drugs that we're seeing now, particularly fentanyl, is so potent and so addictive, so harmful, that it just has a grip on people's lives like we haven't necessarily seen drug use have that type of grip on people's lives before. So I was listening to a speaker the other day, and they actually had a really good explanation. It was someone who used to have an opioid addiction himself. And this was, I think, a really good and explanation that resonated with me about how strong of a grip it can have on people. So he was talking about, he lived in downtown Vancouver and he was going through withdrawal in a park. And he just explained it like it's going through withdrawal is like the worst pain of your life. Like your head hurts, your mouth is dry, your whole body aches, everything hurts, you're feeling anxious, like you can't even believe, so much anxiety, literally everything is in pain. You're like just laying on the ground feeling so sick, like the worst flu that you have ever had. Picture like the worst, most sick you've ever felt in your life, and you know that you can make it, $10 will make it go away. I really resonated with me because I know that when I feel really sick, like I will do anything to make the pain stop. Like you just don't want to be in pain
Oh,
anymore.
yeah.
Yeah. Like you said, like you would go to the drugstore and buy like any flu medicine that they had that you would take that would make this pain go away. So yeah, just imagine that. And if you just go down the street and spend $10 on like a dose that you need, it will all go away. So this type of addiction really has a strong grip on people's lives. And I just think that like it's really important to remember that people from all walks of life have like opioid addictions, and it's not just one type of person. There is so much stigma around it, of course. There's a lot of stigma around drug use, but just because people use drugs, it doesn't mean they don't deserve housing.
That's right.
So that's why it's just so important to support people who are using drugs and support them in a way that there's no expectation that they stop using. We used to have, I think there was sort of a lot of policies around like, first you have to get clean and then you'll be eligible for housing. Get clean, not really like a term that we use, that like I would generally use, but yeah.
Yeah, but what the term that was traditional and an
Yeah.
attitude that was traditionally put out
Yeah, exactly.
to a spectacular failure of results.
Exactly. And so we have this sort of, there's like a sort of philosophy now that's called like housing first, which means first you can house people and then they can access other supports that they need once their basic needs are met. But I also, on top of that, really believe that we have to house people with no conditions. Like there's no conditions of like, well, if you house them, it means you have to be going to AA or you have to be seeking treatment. Some people are not ready for that. And it doesn't mean that they don't deserve housing, and it doesn't mean that we still shouldn't work to support them. So I just think that's one of the really, well, that's the reason that it's so important to provide housing. And it's just not like, I know that some people might feel uncomfortable with that, and they might think, well, they should just be able to go to a shelter where they're not allowed to use. Like, what's so the problem with that? It's not good to use anyways. But it's just, I mean, I don't understand it because I haven't had an opioid addiction, so I can't truly understand it, but it's just so all-encompassing from what I have seen people experience, and it's just so intense. Like it's just not that easy. You can't just say to people, well, you should just go to a place where you can't use, because people will choose to just sleep on the streets in that case, and then they die because they're using alone or they're freezing to death.
And I
Yeah.
think that's the thing to I think you said it really beautifully. One, we should be housing people without conditions. Two, just because someone is is using substances does not mean that they don't deserve housing and support mm-hmm. and life. And when mm-hmm. people callously dismiss and just say, well, they should just go to the shelter or they should just stop using and, you know, mm-hmm. phrases like, you know, they should just get it together. Well, even if you want to take that track, the result is people are dying. The people, like you said, exactly. are going out, they're sleeping outside. They're either dying mm-hmm. of overdoses or they're freezing, they're using mm-hmm. alone. And so I think it's, you know, when we look at, you and I have both worked at summer camp, and when the kids go at the beginning of the week for summer camp, we usually do a swim test. So that way the lifeguards can assess, you know, what's the swimming ability of this, you know, the 50 kids here. And we don't just say, well, either you can't come to camp if you can't swim at all. We put in structures and support pieces mm-hmm. to make sure that everyone is there and it's safe. And to take the metaphor a little further, if we have kids and we think, well, they should just learn to swim, you don't just drop them in the deep end and say, well, figure it out, because mm-hmm. they're going to drown. And what the idea of sending people and saying, well, you have to do the on your own, the incredibly hard mm-hmm. work that folks who have, I mean, people who have, who are, you know, in the top 1% of wealth, who struggle with addiction, relapse multiple times, require rehabilitation facilities, require programming and healthcare. And that still is not a clean and easy road. So the idea mm-hmm. that there's still an attitude out there that folks who are struggling, like we said, to even find a shelter, to even find food, to find mm-hmm. community, that they're somehow magically going to be able to mm-hmm. overcome, you know, we don't want to see anyone who's struggling with addiction and the way it takes and the way it harms. But mm-hmm. the backwards notion that I hope that we're getting beyond, and that great places like the Working Center are finding ways to innovate and to treat mm-hmm. people with dignity. It's really important that we stop the kind of the backwards approach of saying, well, you just have to either get clean or you're out on the street, because the result mm-hmm. is our neighbor. These are people, these are mm-hmm. our neighbors, and they're dying when we take this approach. And so I just think that's a really important thing for us as neighbors, as citizens, as activists, as people who are passionate about this, to understand. I think you put it beautifully. Mm-hmm. Everybody deserves housing. Everybody deserves care. We should be housing people unconditionally.
Yeah, totally. Like you said, even if people have every resource in the world, they still have an extremely difficult time, like, working through their addiction. And yes. even if they have every resource and all the money in the world. So maybe they'll still never work through their addiction. So expecting that from people who don't even have their basic needs met is obviously ridiculous. But yeah, just to think about, then we can think about why people who are using opioids are affected so strongly from the housing crisis, right? Like, people who have had housing, who then fall into this addiction, are not able to pay their rent and ended up on the street. And then there's nowhere for them to go. There's no shelters for them to go. There's no, you know, they can't access, there's not enough supportive housing, or they're not allowed to use if they're in some of these spaces. So this is why it's, like, really affecting these people, and why it's, like, a specifically vulnerable population of people who don't have housing, I think. And yeah, just to speak a little bit, if I can, about safe supply. So I was recently, and I would recommend this book to everyone, I was recently reading the book Overdose by Benjamin Perrin. He is a Canadian researcher, so it speaks specifically to the Canadian opioid crisis. And he talks in his book about how, so far from all of the research that we've done, we can see that rehab doesn't work for people to get off opioids. So rehab being, like, this traditional model of, like, maybe it's a live-in model where you go away for 3 months or 6 months, and it's an abstinence model. And so you don't use and you stop using, and then it's totally abstinent. And then you don't use ever again for the next 3 months, 6 months. And the reality that we've seen actually over and over again, as hard as it is for us to, like, wish that it did work that way, people relapse. And opioids, people lose their tolerance to opioids really, really quickly. So even if you don't use for a few days or a few weeks, and then you use the same amount that you would use again, that can be very harmful and you'll end up overdosing. So people lose their tolerance really quickly. So in fact, when people go to rehab and engage in these abstinence only models, they end up relapsing when they come out, and it's actually more harmful. There's more overdoses and deaths. Wow. And it's just really not an effective model. And that was really like hard to read and learn about, because you want that to work. You want it to work, and you want it to be an effective model. But again, so far, just in all the research we've done, it just really, really hasn't been. People are dying, you know, at rehab if they're able to, you know, get their hands on opioids and then use. And then they're just overdosing in the rooms, or they're dying like after they come out, whatever it is. So another, and again, there's not just going to be one solution, of course, like the housing crisis, there's never going to be one solution, but there is a, something that's come to Kitchener, and models are being, you know, across Canada rolling out, called Safe Supply, where people can, well, there's a few different things. There's one, Safe Supply, where people can access their drugs safely, that basically like as a prescription to them. And then they know that it's not coming from the street, so it's not contaminated. They know exactly how much they're taking. And then there's also programs like methadone that feeds the need for having your opioids without giving you a high. And that is a way that we can help people, again, if they want to and if they're ready, basically to stop using street drugs as much, because they'll take their methadone every day, and then they won't feel as the strong, or the, first of all, they won't experience withdrawal. And that is really important, because people know like withdrawal feels so bad that people will do anything to continue to get their high. So one, if you're taking methadone, you won't experience your withdrawal symptoms, which is really important. And two, you won't feel the need, again, from my understanding, you don't feel the need to use your opioids more, which means, you know, eventually you can sort of start coming off street drugs, and then eventually you can sort of, you know, long term, you can kind of start coming off your methadone and decreasing your methadone dose as well. And that can be one model that people have seen success with in the past. So at UA, just to loop that back in, we had a methadone program there, I believe through the nurse. So every day of people who chose, I think maybe like at the time we had maybe a quarter of the people who were living there who were on the methadone program. And so that was also like one of the ways that we were working to support people who were looking to beat their addiction.
I'm glad you did go on that, because I think it's important for people who are passionate about this, about seeing housing justice, to understand that the reality is that many people are either ending up living close to the streets because of struggles with addiction, or entering into it during their lives that are living close to the street, and we need to be able to respond in an actually effective way. And I think we're far enough now into being able to look back with hindsight, and particularly at, you know, places like the United States and in Canada too, on in the 80s, what was known as the war on drugs, which we can now, you know, without any serious debate, understand what a colossal failure and how counterproductive that approach was. Yes. And in many ways, we're still continuing that counterproductive approach with how we think about housing. And so for those who are passionate about, you know, showing up to city council meetings and public consultation meetings, it's really critical that I think everyday people understand the importance of Safe Supply and as you're talking about it, and understand why. And again, I would hope that we would just trust that the organizations that are working on the front lines know better than those of us who can sit back from our easy, like our lazy boys here, and just say what we think should happen. But let's assume that people are like me, and they're an armchair quarterback who's always yelling at the TV and watching sports and telling them how they should be running the play, or how the Blue Jays should be pitching today. Cause that is me. Yeah. I will say it's really, really important that we understand why protecting safe supply and why caring and supporting folks who are who are living with addictions is critical to getting them on a path to healing and health and getting them on a path to being housed. So I really do appreciate you kind of laying that out for us, what it looks like at UA, at the Working Center, and why it's important that we are there, not to judge, not to try and take an approach that is just going to end up with people going out alone onto the streets, but actually is a way to keep people in the community and in and inside places that have those supports.
Yeah, and it's just really important to pay attention to the experts and pay attention to the research. You know, like, I'm not a full expert on, you know, methadone and safe supply, but there are people out there who are. And as you were talking about the war on drugs being like a total failure, I think this book, again, it's called Overdose by Benjamin Perrin, is really, really excellent because Benjamin Perrin used to work for Stephen Harper while he was in government and actually helped roll out the war on drugs program, like just like ideology in the Stephen Harper's government. And he was like a full believer and supporter of the war on drugs. And when he finished working for Harper, he's a professor at a university, and he came back, he's from Vancouver, and he saw, wow, like, people are just dying at like a more incredible rate than before. What's going on here? And started to dive in and do his own research, and ultimately by the end was convinced that he was totally wrong before, and even caused a lot of harm in like the policies that were rolled out. And but that means he's able to speak like very genuinely to what the research that he has actually done, to the really, really good, valuable research that he's done on the opioid crisis. So read that book.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that in the description. I think that's a great thing. Can you talk a little more as we kind of move on here about what life was like in UA? And so I know particularly the just from friends and other folks, Keegan, who was part of the hub team for many years, worked at the Working Center, and as did many other camp folks, and I know that the Working Center just has a really beautiful approach of understanding their reciprocal relationships with those whom they work alongside, and not this hierarchical model of here's the staff, or here's the saviors, and here's the folks that are clients or something like that, but really understanding reciprocal relationships. Can you talk a little bit about what life is like at UA while you were there, what that experience was like, and maybe some key things that you took away from that experience working in supportive housing there?
So that's great. I think that the question really is like, what does it look like when you take 70 people who were living on the streets, like sleeping rough, living on the streets, many of whom are people who use drugs, and put them into one four-story building with 70 rooms. And it's a university dorm building, by the way, like that's how it's set up. I believe Laurier used to rent it as a dorm building for their students. But because it was COVID, students were online and the building went up for rent, and Laurier wasn't renting it because the students were working from home online. And they rented it. So that's what it's set up like. If you kind of want a bit of a visual in your head, there's four
floors. Good. That's helpful.
Yeah, four floors, and everyone has their own room, and then there's like dorm style bathrooms. So that's how it's set up. And I wasn't there right at the beginning. I started working there in April 2021, and they opened in October 2020. It sort of went like, there was a honeymoon period where everyone was like, whoa, this is amazing. We have a place to sleep, and we have keys to our room, and we can come and go when we want. And then it got hard, because living in close proximity is hard, and living in community is hard. Yes. And it was, and then after a few months, sort of when I started onboarding, I remember being told, we're building a bit of a backbone in the community, a bit of like some, you know, central pillars that are sort of holding the community together. And we're kind of pulling ourselves together and figuring out what this is going to look like and what it looks like for people to live together. And now sort of when I was working at St. John's Kitchen, I was talking to someone who was still working at UA and asking her how things were going. And she was saying about how they were sort of in a phase where they were able to start supporting people to move on to more permanent housing. So UA is much more permanent than like a shelter, but the Mancinis, I remember them saying, actually advocated that when they were doing that big homelessness count, I believe in September 2021, that these people were still counted like they did not have a permanent shelter. Like this wasn't like a permanent housing. So these people are still considered because it's a transitional housing. So the goal is still to help these folks who are living in UA go on to even more permanent housing. So now they're in a role where they've actually sort of stabilized enough that they've actually been able to help people move into more permanent housing. So those are some sort of the phases I think that they saw. And I think that it was wild and crazy working there, and it was also fun and beautiful, and it's just like being in any other community. Lots of people don't get along. It's a 70 person, you know, about 70 people that are living there. Not everyone gets along, and some people get along really well, and some people barely come out of the room because they don't like to interact with people, and some people hang out in the common areas all the time because they always want to interact with people. And in that way, it was just like any other community that you'd see.
Exactly. And
I think that what I learned there actually was, or at least what was sort of reiterated in my mind, is the importance of having a community. We actually had a resident move out. He had the opportunity to rent a place with some friends of his in a way that he was able to afford. And he moved out at that time when I was working there. And we were like, this is amazing. He's getting permanent housing. And it definitely was good in a lot of ways, but he kept coming back around because he was lonely in his new housing. All of a sudden he was living in a place that where he had a few roommates who may or may not have been there all the time, but then that's it. He was in the house by himself, and he was used to living in a building with 60 or 70 other people that he could, you know, visit with all the time if he wanted, like people who had become close friends, people who were close friends, a family, even like we have like siblings and couples and stuff living in there. And so I think that I really learned about the importance of community because it showed me like literally every single person needs community, and it can be a really hard thing and there can be a lot of problems. It can be very imperfect. But people still need a sense of community and a sense of connection.
I think again, as we, there's so many pieces that for those of us who have not had the same experiences being with housing insecurity, with being street involved, with living close to the streets, there's so many ways. I think initially we can look at it and just go, wow, I just can't even, I can't even imagine what the needs are and what the experiences is like. And, you know, of course, in so many ways, we have to come with humility and recognize that we don't understand, like we said, what is it like to, you know, have all your possessions have to travel with you at all times, to be shuffled from in and out of somewhere every night. And at the same time, there's so many pieces of this that, like, as you said, you know, what would we do without our communities? Whether that's, you know, family systems or friend units or those cells, those bodies that are around us of people who know us, who we can go to, who we can just relax with, and the exhaustion, particularly for those who aren't in a place where they can get that, either because of having barriers to accessing supportive housing or barriers to accessing community in certain ways, and there's lots of reasons why those barriers would come up. The exhaustion of not only having to figure out every day how you're going to get through that day, but to do it to 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 feel like you're doing it alone. I think it's really important that's something that we can all identify with, of the need for community in our lives, and the legs that it gives us to be able to move forward.
I've seen, just from my past year of experience, I think that people often who are street involved hold even closer to their community than others, because it's almost like vital to keep you going. You need support, you know, when you're out of this, or your sleeping bag's wet, or you need a light, then like you hold closely to the people that are close to you. That's what I've seen, just working at the kitchen, working at UA. But yeah, it's totally imperfect. Like it's a challenging thing, and it is challenging having all these different people living in the building together, but you know, people who want to live there, keep living there. The really neat thing, I remember someone from the working center who said this to me. The neat thing is that people at the working center, they said, have been hearing for years, and we've maybe heard this as well, have been hearing for years, oh, well, people live on the streets because they choose to live on the streets. They want to live on the streets. If they didn't want to, oh, well, then why aren't they trying harder to get housing? And, you know, just a lot of sentiments like that. Like people who are on the streets, it's because they want to be there. They're choosing to live on the streets. I've heard even people close to me saying that. And someone from the working center said to me, it's been interesting because we have basically proven or shown that people who are living on the streets, when given housing, actually stayed. Like almost everyone chose to stay in housing when it was offered to them, in a way that was low barrier or no barrier for them, right? There weren't all these other barriers for them about like not being able to bring their pets or not being able to stay with their families. When there was no or low barrier housing offered to them, people stayed, and they're still staying, and they're living there. It kind of helps prove that, like, you know, people aren't living on the street because it's a choice. Maybe they feel it's their best option, but it's not their most preferred option, you know, from what we've seen.
Yeah. And one thing that, that I know from conversations with other folks that I actually, that speaks so much to what you just said is that, it actually is hard. We know that getting people housed is one thing. And sometimes the line is that comes after that is keeping people housed is a challenge. But I think what it really speaks to is the fact that keeping people housed in the current systems that we have is the challenge. But understanding that there are ways to rethink our approaches, our perceptions to housing, to supportive housing, to healthcare programs, to how we see our neighbors, shifting that is what we need to do, because it is a challenge to keep people housed if we keep taking the same approach to things, saying, well, eventually you just need to be able to work your way up to, you know, somehow afford a down payment and a mortgage in a climate where that is out of reach for people who are households with multiple full-time jobs. So I think that's a really important thing to recognize, that when we talk about getting people housed and the challenge of keeping people housing, the challenge lies in the absurdity of continuing to take the same approach to housing that we have for so long. And we need to take heed of places like the working center and the work that is happening, and I should say the community that is happening at UA, to understand and see, much like how we need to evolve our approach with the opioid crisis, we need to actually respond to what's happening, and we need to actually take a look at what's working and what isn't, and not just try and continue the same approach based on presumptions that have been completely disproven. And so I think that's a really, really beautiful thing to look at, and to take the case study of UA, and see that, like you said, the success that's come, not the perfect success, not saying that all of a sudden it is this perfect utopian society and everything works and it's all one linear track to getting everybody into their own place. It's really important for us to look at the complexity, the messiness, but also, like you said, the beauty of the community that has taken place there, and to recognize that there's not, like you said, one size fits all solution to everything, but that this is what it looks like to take an approach where folks who are street involved are able to speak to what their needs are and are able to have the dignity to have agency over their own over their own path, and to have a support system around that takes that into account and supports where they're at. So I think that UA is just a really beautiful example of how to really effectively respond in the realm of supportive housing.
Yeah, I commend the Working Center for trying something new. I mean, maybe they're not the first people ever, or the first organization ever to do something like this, but it does, like you said, it takes change. We're seeing problems that we haven't seen before in the opioid crisis and in the housing crisis. And that means we need solutions that we haven't necessarily seen before.
That's right, yeah.
We need to look at, you know, not just rely on our old outdated presumptions, and it takes trying something new to see how it will go. I remember actually the job listing on Indeed when I originally read it said, this is a housing experiment and we are just trying to figure this out as we go. And that is really exactly what it was. I mean, they said right there on the job posting, this is a housing experiment. And I don't remember the exact words, but basically, yeah, we're figuring this out as we go. And that is, you know, what's happening, what was happening, and what is happening, I'm sure, still. And there's always new things to learn. And, but it takes a new type of housing experiment or safe supply. Like before that, people might have thought it was crazy to prescribe people their opioids.
Opioids. Completely counterintuitive.
Exactly. Totally. But it took some people to start doing that, to try a new approach, because our current approaches just weren't working, to see a change. I think this really, that's what UA is. It's a housing experiment, and it's one, just to wrap it around, like it's one solution. And there needs to be many different approaches and many different solutions to the housing crisis. And this is one that will work for, or that's working for some portion of the population.
Yeah, because everybody's needs are different and everybody's situations are different, and everybody's ability to exist in community differs the same way it does with those of us who live with neighbors who down our street who drive us crazy, or other neighbors who we go over and, you know, watch a hockey game every week. Yeah. You know, again, this is not understanding that these are our neighbors who have the same ups and downs with the community that we do. And Gemma, I think it takes a lot of courage and intestinal fortitude to basically look at a job posting that's essentially saying we're gonna build the plane while we're flying it, which is essentially how many people would get into the plane that's still being built. And so I'm really grateful for the work that you do, and for you to be just another example for us on this series of how to take kind of the learning and the theory. And what I often talk about is when we're behind sort of the glass window and able to just be looking at things from a distance, to actually cross through that threshold and to put it into practice. And again, for those of us who come from liberative lens, Jesus tradition, to live discipleship in that incarnational way, to be able to be in lived experience in relationship is a really important thing. And my hope is as we go on with the series, we're continuing to highlight people like you who have taken the theory, the academic, the learning piece, where so many of us get to with something we're passionate about, especially with justice issues, and then we stop and understand how can we get over from that first step into action, and again, it's going to look a million different ways, as it has with Steph Stretch or Kirsten Wright, who we've talked with, or anyone else. It's going to look different how we actually take action and get involved. But to go from theory and learning to action, I think is a really important step that we all need to understand. How can we take that step in action? And your courage in stepping in a week after you finished your undergrad and going,
I was ready to go
and going right into it as the working center themselves were figuring out is really beautiful and really inspiring. And I'm really grateful for you being able to be here this week and share your story and share your experiences with the Working Center and with the amazing work that's happening at the community at UA. So thanks very much for sharing.
Yeah, thank you. Can I say one sort of call to action?
Yes, please do. Yeah.
So if you're listening to this podcast, please write your elected officials, call your elected officials, especially municipally, but I think in any level of government. I've realized that people who are against consumption treatment services, or CTS for short, people who are against CTS and safe supply and harm reduction are doing those things, and they are being loud and they are writing their elected officials. It's been happening in Cambridge, especially. They've been trying to get their CTS off the ground and they haven't been able to. And there has been a lot of pushback from the community. So, you know, they're being loud, but we need to be louder. Who are against this are speaking up about it, and we need to speak up about it as well. They are loud and they are reaching out to their representatives, and they are writing letters and they are making phone calls saying, don't bring safe supply to our community. Don't bring harm reduction to our community. We've seen it happen in Cambridge. I was actually doing a bit of research for something, and I was coming across the meeting where they were discussing which location they might put the CTS in on the Cambridge City Council. And the people who wrote in that day for, like, you can submit your letters to the council, were majority people saying, we don't want either location. We don't want this in our community. We don't want this at all. So they are loud and we need to be louder. I just feel really passionate about that. Just please, please call and write and meet whenever you can, meet with your elected officials and tell them that this is something you want and this is something you care about, because people on the other side are doing the same and they're making their voices heard. We need to make our voices heard too. So that's my call to action.
Awesome. Yeah. And again, a great reminder, even as we talked about this past week, election season now, federally, provincially, and municipally has come and gone. But the work does not stop after we cast a ballot. In fact, now we have city councils, we have regional councils. A lot of the stuff happens at the regional level as well, but that's right. The municipal level does have a lot to say over specific projects, where they go and safe supply. And you've done a really great job, Gemma, for us of painting the intersection with safe supply and with supportive housing and with housing justice. Mm-hmm. So that is a great call to action. That's our hope and our challenge and our prayer to people, that we would move from just podcasts can just be the idea of consuming information. We hope that this series is a way to help people get active and be informed so that they can be equipped to act. And so I'm really grateful for your work, Gemma, and for you coming on this week. And I hope to have you back and chat more about the intersections that you've seen, especially with your background in the trauma-informed approach in peace and conflict studies and in housing justice. So thanks for being here this week, and thanks for all you're doing to help move housing justice forward and help move the needle from housing crisis to housing justice in our communities. Thanks for being here, Gemma.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, awesome. Well, we will be back next time with more from Winter is Coming. And as we continue to look at this, we encourage you to check out organizations like the Working Center. Find out what they're doing. Find out how you can support them. They have fundraisers every year. They need volunteers. They need staff. And they need people in their corner supporting the work that they do. And Cambridge especially also needs that now more than ever. So find out how you can get involved, make your voice heard, and help support these organizations that are living out housing justice and are doing amazing things in our community. So for Winter is Coming, thank you for being here again, Gemma. I'm Adam Cresswell, and we will see you next time.